This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello everyone, just a quick interjection. Is that a word? From me. Basically, what you're about to listen to was recorded in November or December, so they might talk about just how amazing Steven Schumacher is and how good the ride is. They might talk about Finn Zaz. They might even talk about Luke Cundall. Doubt it, but they might. So just to let you know, this was recorded November, December time, before the shit hit the fan, shall we say, and might be slightly outdated, but that just affects a few little bits. Please enjoy, and I will hand you back to the recording. Thank you.
Hello again, and welcome back to another episode of My Argyle Life, brought to you by the Argyle Life Green and White Podcast. As many of you know, having listened to this series before, if you haven't, if not, where have you been? This is a series that looks into the lives of people connected to Argyle. We've been on the terraces with many of our great fans, some great stories to tell. We've even been on the pitch and in the dressing room with David Norris, as I'm sure many of you will have heard. Today we're taking a step into the club offices with former media man Dan Cole. Joining me today is also Finlay Allen, who also has worked with Argyle in the media and is also a contributor to Argyle Life. Dan, how are you doing this evening?
Very well, thank you. How about yourself, Sam?
Yeah, very good. I'm a little bit caught up in traffic coming out of work. As you know, we're a little bit later starting than planned, but other than that, doing okay. Finn, how are you?
All good, thank you. Looking forward to the game this weekend and, hopefully get 3 points.
Yeah, well, we will know by the time this goes out whether we have. This is going out slightly later in the year. So this is the Sunderland game for context, if any of you want to place that in your minds, talk with some of the conversations we're going to have tonight. So, Dan, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about, we'll go on to it in more detail in a moment, and we'll go through your life as an Argyle fan. But before we get started, for anybody listeners who maybe don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the job you did at Argyle and what your job role was?
Yeah, of course. So I joined the club in, like everyone here, you know, an Argyle fan all my life, but I joined the club in January of the 2018-19 season as communications officer in a department then of two people. And unfortunately, that was obviously the season we got relegated. And then I stayed through until the summer, just as we got promoted back to the Championship. I moved on. So what's that, 4.5 years? So it encompasses quite a lot of change, probably more change than at any other point in the club's history, to be honest, from down from League One that season. Then we got up through that League Two promotion with Ryan Lowe, then the COVID season, then the change to Steven Schumacher and that 80-point season, and then obviously the amazing title-winning season last season. So it was 4.5 years, an amazing 4.5 years, obviously a dream job, but it somehow feels like a lot longer because of kind of everything that we squeezed into that time period.
Yeah, I don't think you could have had a much more eventful 4.5 years, and obviously we will go into that in far greater detail over the next half an hour to an hour or so. But before we do, let's talk a little bit about your Argyle life growing up. So what was your story of getting into Argyle? When did you start going to games? Who brought you to games?
Well, it was probably probably quite a common story for most people in the area around that time. I was grew up in the 90s, just a little bit too young for my dad to take me along to Wembley, unfortunately. But I remember them leaving that morning and being furious that I wasn't allowed to go along. But I kind of, the first manager I remember, that first sort of team I remember was the kind of Warnock team. I tried to think ahead of this. I couldn't remember exactly when my first game was. The first game I can sort of vaguely remember, I think, was a home victory over York City. And I think that Bruce Grobbelaar had maybe just signed or was maybe having his first game or something around that time. I'm sure that's wrong, but those are my memories. So sort of 96, 97. Then I sort of dipped in and out because I was still, you know, quite young then. And then like most people of my generation, I kind of got hooked around the time we started getting really very good. So I managed to enjoy the kind of, I think my first season with the season ticket, would you believe, the luck of it was the 01-02 promotion season. And then I had a season ticket right through until sort of like, you know, my late teens when I went, and then early 20s when I went traveling and I went to uni and so on. And then obviously managed to come and work for the club after. So my dad got me into it, like with most people. He worked in the dockyard and he kind of would drag me along to start with until I got hooked. And then it was a family thing. Every weekend we would kind of build our weekends around going to Argyle away games as well. I travelled on the Cornish supporters coaches run by John Simmons to lots of those away games around that time. So I mean, it was kind of an amazing time to really become a you know, hooked Argyle fan because we were so good. I got used to us winning all the time. And obviously, wasn't ready for the period that followed after that.
No, it absolutely was, Dan. And I think being of a similar-ish age to myself, we both had a similar trajectory. We both started becoming addicted to Argyle during the good times, and we both kind of had the slight privilege of moving away for university and doing other things during the maybe the decline years. And for me, it was the really awful years. And obviously then that must have been an incredible formative time to be a fan, the Paul Sturrock years, obviously going into the Ian Holloway years, and we all know how it fell apart after. And so before we go into your circumstances around you getting the job, what were your main highlights to the fans and your favourite players during that era?
Funnily enough, because I obviously ended up bringing him into the media stuff at Argyle, my first kind of favourite player was Ian Stonebridge, actually, just before we picked up, because he was a striker. He scored goals, not that we scored that many in that era, but he scored most of them, him and Paul McGregor, I think, from memory. So he was probably my first favourite player. And then you get into that kind of 0102 team and you can, how are they not all your favourite? You know, there were just so many legends of the team. It's hard to split them, isn't it? But, Frio obviously holds a special place in most fans' hearts. You know, Paul Watton as that kind of hometown hero story thing. Trigger. Like I said, you know, you could pick them all out. I had a soft spot for Tony Capaldi as well. Something about left-footed players that works for me, has always worked for me. So, but, you know, David Norris, who you had on, you know, previously, just so many superstars, really, not just of that era, but they kind of stack up against most of the greats of our club, don't they?
Yeah, they absolutely do. So you obviously went away to university. What was it that led you into the sort of communications world? And is that what you always wanted to get into, or is that sort of something you sort of fell into, maybe?
Well, I think like a lot of, I'm probably like quite a lot of people in that. I was failed at actually being a footballer myself. I was useless. Tried my best. I think I played a little while at centre back at school, but not very mobile. And then I started playing tennis when I was youngest. I had decent hand eye coordination. I was quite large, and the goals were quite small, so they put me in goal at school. And actually, I played with there's a couple of years younger than me, but Ollie Chenoweth, who briefly had pro deal at Argyle, they stuck him outfield because he had some talent, and they stuck me in goal. But I mean, I couldn't play, but it was what I was passionate about. I could write. I started sort of scrapbooking and writing up, you know, like match reports and so on at home. This was kind of prior to the internet and being able to sort of post them online anywhere. I would just write them write them in books at home and you know, take press clippings and so on and try and keep my own little record really of Argyle. And that was always something that interested me, but it's not outlandish to say that it was a dream job for me, and it's a dream job for a lot of people. So I didn't necessarily think I'd ever end up to get it. So, you know, I went and studied media and journalism and was working at Marjon, which was where I'd studied, and I saw the job come up at the club, and I thought, I've got to go for it. But I thought, you know, me and everyone else in Plymouth probably and beyond. And lo and behold, I won the lottery. It feels like I won the lottery and got the job and got in at the club, which was obviously an amazing feeling.
Absolutely.
Very grateful to have had the opportunity. I mean, I'm sure lots of people would have killed for it, and I never took that for granted.
I'm sure. So just going on to that transition then from being a fan to a club employee. And I actually, if I remember back in the days when I was a regular poster on Pasotti, I know you were as well. And in fact, I think we even were involved in the same sort of charity football event, weren't we, way back in 2009. So I've kind of known you on and off for quite a while, Dan. And so how did you find that transition? Because I remember back in Pasotti, that was the days when, not that it isn't now, of course, but it was very vigorous, very thriving, lots of very full-blooded debate. And people would kind of have quite severe disagreements over, you know, stuff to do with the football team, whether that be the players, the manager, the board. How did you feel kind of going from somebody who was a contributor online to all that discourse, for want of a better word, with all these different varying opinions, to somebody who was now a representative of the club? That must have been a big step.
Yeah, it's really surreal, as you can imagine, for a bunch of reasons. I wasn't sort of, yeah, you're right. I did post on Twitter a lot when I was younger, but I think there was a brief period in time which I didn't, which probably helped me kind of. There are a few years where I sort of migrated slightly out of that cycle, which is handy, because probably I would have, like most people, had posted some criticism of the club from time to time or things that I didn't agree with, and that wouldn't have helped very well when the club were doing their due diligence. So, I mean, I think the biggest thing was, you know, you realise how careful you have to be with everything that you say once you work for the club. You're obviously then rubbing shoulders with people you've to one degree or another kind of idolised or look up to or consider sort of these mythical heroes, and now you're in the room with them. And I think quite quickly, well, maybe not quickly, but you do quite soon realise that the power dynamic is not what you think it is. So the players or the staff or whoever actually look to you as the media department, your job is to preserve and enhance the reputations of everybody who works there. So the responsibility is quite significant, really. And you'll find that I sort of found after time that shift of me going in and thinking, oh, crikey, that's Derek Adams or that's whoever, you know, quite quickly that becomes them looking to you, and maybe the result hasn't been great or something's going on, and you really need to kind of steer the club's messaging through kind of choppy waters and protect everybody to some extent. So that's quite an interesting experience, going through that kind of going from a supporter to a spokesperson is challenging, interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about the power dynamic. I never really thought of it that way, because I guess to an extent that if a player is getting a little stick from the fans, or if they've, you know, maybe made a mistake in the game that's cost a goal or whatever, or there's a bit of negative media coverage, they're kind of looking to you to shield them from that to some extent. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the experience, obviously the club was not anything close, but the club that I left in the summer, well, they don't really feel like I've left, to be honest, but the club that I left in the summer was so different, so very different in almost every way to the club I joined in January of 2019. You know, we were, when I joined the club, we were operating out of Plumer House up in Crown Hill, because the grandstand was being redeveloped, so there weren't any offices down there. There were some, I think you'll probably remember that the team changing rooms were a porta cabin outside the front of the Devonport end. It was disjointed and it was confusing and it was. I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
No. I think it was just about the transition
and the reputations of the players. So anyway, I think so. Obviously, we all know how that season went, and I'm sure we can get onto that in specifics later if you like. But I mean, one example, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying, because we've remained quite good friends, is Scott Whitten. So he obviously was in and out of the team in that season. It didn't have the best of seasons. Personally, I think it was a kind of a combination of factors. He was obviously signed to replace Sonny Bradley, who did an amazing job. The team wasn't going very well. He wasn't playing as much as he liked. And obviously, I think I'm pretty sure he was well out of the picture at the end of that League One season. He wasn't getting a game. He might have been on the bench, possibly. And then when Ryan came in the summer, obviously everything changed. And as we know, Scott played most of the season in the back three in the promotion season. And we actually did some work together. And, you know, he wanted it to work and it hadn't worked so far. And we did some work together on a pretty open interview, like a more kind of you can get your kind of standard football fodder interview that goes on the club website. And sometimes you can get your slightly more honest ones. And we sat down and we did it properly. And we talked about where he felt had gone wrong, how he felt he could contribute, how he wanted the fans to give him a chance, really. Ryan knew that he was going to give him a chance. He was going to play him. So it was important to Ryan, important to the squad, that everybody kind of fell in behind and gave Scott another go, basically. And obviously I think the work that we did together, and obviously his performances primarily, but certainly he had another chance and he contributed to a promotion winning season. And I think that's an example of where, if you're working together as a club and everyone's on the same page, you can genuinely make a difference to the perception of a player among the fan base. And I think by the time he left, everybody was appreciative of the contribution he made. And that maybe wouldn't have been the case 12, 18 months previous.
No, I absolutely couldn't agree more. And I remember there was a real sea change in opinion around that time. And I think, obviously, again, we'll maybe come on to the kind of vibe of this era in a little bit more. But when Ryan Lowe and his coaching team came in, there was that incredible feeling of refreshment and reinvigoration around the club. Everyone was so excited, even though we just got relegated. It was the most excited anybody had been going into a new season in probably ages, which was mad. But, well, before we can go on to the good times then, because there were an awful lot of them, it's probably... would be remiss if we didn't at least touch on those 4 or 5 months really from when you joined to relegation. So you said there was a team of two. Was that yourself and Rick? Would that be right, Rick?
Yeah, Calder? That's right. Yeah.
And was Robert Nicol not there with you, or was him left before you?
Yeah. I actually came in to replace Rob because
he left
earlier that season. Obviously, he's back with us now. But so I came in to replace Rob. And there was a chap called Nino, who you may or may not have met, who worked part-time with us as well. But really, obviously, really small department. Pretty common for the time, but obviously it was there, as you've seen, there's obviously been a huge shift in the importance that clubs place in their own media departments. Argyle were they were already going that way. I think COVID kind of moved that along a little bit more, because suddenly media was the only way that you could follow your team for a season and a bit. But yes, it was a small department. It was probably indicative of the size of the staffing structure of the entire club, really, which was that there weren't that many of us at that time. The club was in a real period of transition, I think, off the pitch as much as on it. And I think, I think everybody knew where we were trying to get to. And it became clear in the following sort of 12 months or so, when everyone got back into the grandstand got finished and we got back together and where it was going. But I think it's really difficult to operate the football club that way. So, I mean, I think people have said as much. I won't be the first person to say it, but I think even Derek said he felt it had an impact. Looking back, he always said he felt it had an impact on the way the club was able to function that season. But I mean, a lot of those decisions obviously predated me, but when I came in sort of towards the back end of the project, the redevelopment project, but they had to do something, didn't they? You know, so I think it was kind of a period in which everyone just sort of had to make do until the grandstand got done.
Yeah, absolutely. So what was that like, that sort of atmosphere? Because I think, you know, it's no secret. I mean, obviously, you know, by all means, don't feel you have to say anything specific, that the Derek Adams era did not end very well. There was a bit of a bad mood, a bit of a feeling of discontentment. I guess that made your job so much harder going into that job, knowing it was a club that was struggling and the club that, where there were a few problems. How was that holding that together from the media point of view in that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard. I think, I wasn't blind to where the club was, but I also believed, like we had the season previous, I believed that we had enough about us to get out of trouble. And then obviously I came in January, and we just about picked up around that time. So we obviously beat Oxford on New Year's Day. I think we beat Coventry. I think Ruben Lamira scored twice. We beat Coventry 2-1 at home. We put a decent run of form together, and it really did look as though three quarters of the way through the season, certainly, it looked as though we were going to be fine, didn't it? We certainly had enough about us in the final third. You felt to score enough goals to win enough games to get over the line, and you know it was challenging, and I don't think it was particularly anybody's fault. The kind of the facilities at that point in time do make it harder. I think we had some important injuries, and then I remember I think we beat Shrewsbury at home, didn't we? I think Carey scored a last minute penalty. We won 2-1.
Yep.
About 10 games to go. And I remember looking at, we'd printed off the last 10 games. I remember looking at them and thinking, there aren't a lot of points there. You know, I think we had three or four of the real serious front runners at home. We had a lot of difficult games away. But I remember thinking at the time, there aren't a lot of points there, but we probably only need about six. You know, we probably only need about two wins from the final nine games, and surely we'll do that. And of course, we didn't. And it got harder. It got more tense. I think possibly we lost seven in a row, something like that. We had those two gilt-edged opportunities where we were winning going into stoppage time against, was it Bristol Rovers at home? And we were 2-0 up at Blackpool, weren't we? And not only were we 2-0 up, but we were 2-0 up and Carey had a free kick that was tipped onto the post at 2-0 with about 3 minutes to go. And I remember kind of prepping the match report and writing something pithy about how, you know, next to Pleasure Beach and Argyle were on their holidays or something like that. And obviously it never came to pass. And a month later, I mean, I don't think I'll ever forget Accrington. I think anybody who was involved to any degree in the stands, in the club, on the pitch would ever forget Accrington. We were flat. We were dead flat. But I think I think you talked about Ryan's the kind of that summer where Ryan and Stephen and everyone came in and we rejuvenated the squad and we were close to back at the stadium altogether, and there was that good feeling. But I actually think that for me the kind of, one of the more uplifting weeks kind of in totality, actually, it's bizarre to say, in my time working there, was the week building up to Scunthorpe when Nance got put in. And we had this kind of siege mentality, and obviously it didn't work out as we'd hoped, but I think it showed what the club had the potential to be. Well, everybody, like, you know, we all bought in together for this kind of one common goal, one week thing. We win this game, surely Southend won't beat Sunderland at home. Surely a win will be enough and we'll be fine. So let's all lump in together. And, you know, the stadium was close to full. And it was noisy, and kind of everyone got in behind Nance, who's obviously an incredibly likable character. It's really easy to fall in behind Nance anyway. But and I know we got relegated, but I left that thinking, if we could harness that in some sort of longer term way, that's what the club is at its best. And obviously in the next sort of 3 or 4 years, we've really been able to do that on a regular basis. And now we find ourselves back in the championship, which is just amazing.
Absolutely. And Finn, I will bring you in a minute, because I know that we're going on now to the era where you started working at Argyle's Media, but obviously we all know how things went. We did the job, but sadly Southend, Sunderland didn't want to help us out, did they? And Southend beat Sunderland. Yeah. Still hold a grudge against Sunderland to this day for that, but but hey, we ended up okay. We certainly ended up better than Southend, so we can't argue too much with that. But anyway, so we obviously go down. We knew already we were going to look for a new manager. That was going to be the case, irrespective of the outcome. Naturally, obviously, Derek had been dismissed on the Sunday night before. Obviously, it became fairly clear to, let's be honest, it wasn't much. It wasn't a incredibly well kept secret, and that's nothing against you, I'm sure, because I know how football world works. Agents talk to people, leak stuff to the press, but it became a fairly kind of open secret, didn't it? That Argyle were targeting Ryan Lowe as the first choice, and that was the case for a long time. It got a little bit dragged out, but he eventually came in. So Ryan Lowe, very very different character to Derek Adams, I imagine.
Very, and I should point out, because I haven't been explicit on it, I really like Derek. I thought he was such a great guy, just to be really clear, because obviously I just came in at the point in which it had all sort of just gone wrong for everyone. he was what you didn't see. You know, he obviously has, as all managers do, to varying degrees, a media persona. But off camera, I mean, he did everything he possibly could for the club. And I think at the time, you know, the resources and the structure wasn't available to him that it is now, you know, that it is for managers now. And he carried the club on his back in a lot of ways. I think it's probably, I probably witnessed just kind of an exhaustion at the end of 4 years of really hard graft for him. But, you know, I've got a lot of respect for Derek. I'm obviously pleased to see he's gone on and got a move back to Ross County, which he seems very happy with. So I'm really pleased with him. And I think it was really hard to see like a kind of such a character, such an Argyle. He was an Argyle bloke, Derek, if you know what I mean. To go in the way that he did was just really, really difficult. But yeah, Ryan, I think the thing that made it take longer was obviously Berry's position and the legal process, I think, that had to take place there in terms of getting Ryan and Shiri out of their contracts or however it worked. And, you know, I think it was going to be different based on whether Berry were in the league and so on and so forth. It was just probably a nightmare to deal with for legal types. But I think what they did was they just sold the club, didn't they? They sold the club in a way that it needed to be sold. They emphasised all of the things we knew that were strong about the club, and they brought the players with them that had had success elsewhere. And yeah, it was just kind of an injection of energy at a time in which the club was really receptive to that anyway. It was ready to push on. And obviously we had some really difficult times in between those seasons, but in the end, I think possibly we may not be in as strong a position now if we had limped into another season in League One at the time, because you go down, your squad makeup's different, you're able to give chances to different types of players that maybe you wouldn't have tried in League One. You're able to bring in players who have just won promotion from the level, which is quite a rare thing to be able to do. And yeah, I mean, we immediately started to play. We played kind of really brave attacking. I mean, it was, you know, we had our highs and lows early on there, didn't we? But, you know, you could see what we were trying to do. And players like Danny Mayer, they just get you off the seat. And obviously at a time in which we'd lost Carey and Lemiras, we needed to replace that with something, and we did. And yeah, we just got, I think we just, everyone just stood a little bit taller, didn't they? And everyone just fancied that we were going to win more games, and confidence breeds throughout the club. And yeah, they were the right appointment. Ryan was the right appointment at the right time, no question.
Absolutely. And with that then, going on to yourself, Finn, I believe this was around the time you started working at Argyle. So obviously this was the media team starting to fill out a little bit. So Finn, how did you find it coming into that environment? And forgive me, just reiterate maybe for those who don't know you, of the listeners, exactly what your role was with Argyle Finn. Was it you coming in on a voluntary basis or work experience?
Yeah,
is that so right?
It was work experience, yeah. I mean, first of all, I'd really like to say to Dan personally that he's a massive reason for where I am, what I'm doing now, even if less indirectly, because I'm not currently doing media. He gave me that opportunity. Like I was kind of in the same position as Dan, really, you know, a massive fan of the club and interested in media, and just, you know, really wanting to give that a go and love football, you know, and also wasn't able to be a footballer as well. So it kind of the same sort of path to that. So yeah, basically I was doing media at college. And I believe the way that it worked, I think it was my first article for Argyle Life. It was my first podcast I'd just been on, because I was just starting to want to do my own sort of opinion pieces, fan orientated pieces on the club. And still a contributor actually now to Argyle Life, Nick Saunders-Smith came to me and said, do you want to start writing some pieces for Argyle Life? Because funnily enough, we had just beaten Forest Green. It sticks in my mind, 1-0, Anthony Sarcevic, absolutely screamer into the top corner. And that was an amazing day. But yeah, on the field. But unfortunately, at Forest Green, I'm a wheelchair user, and Forest Green don't have any, I believe still now, don't have any accessible seating for away fans in their
away end, so they have to sit in the home end. And unfortunately, in that game, I experienced some abuse because of my disability and things. And I, you know, I wanted to write an article about, well, one, how things generally need to change with discrimination in football, but also, you know, how Forest Green and clubs across the EFL pyramid can do better for that. And I believe that's still, you know, it's worth me pointing out, I believe that's still the case about 5 years later as well. Yeah, and then Dan saw that and came to me and said, you know, I really like a piece of what you're writing, and do you want to have a go at, you know, doing some work experience in the media at Argyle? And it was just like a cliche, but a dream come true, you know, because it was like, you know, Argyle was and still is a massive part of my life. So it was like, yeah, let's try and tie these things together. And I believe, Dan, you pretty much messaged me the week before, said, what was your college hours at the time? And then I came, was it like the next week I was already in? Like, yeah, it was pretty quick.
Yeah, it sounds about right. We just had to have a chat about your Twitter account with me at the time, because it was pretty risky.
I was like Dan on Twitter at the time, you know, again, quite opinionated about the club and stuff, whatever. But and yeah, we went in there and it was like a, because obviously I won't go into detail, but when we were in the office, we'd obviously would have lots of conversations about, you know, what had happened the season before, because I was interested. It felt like it changed so quickly in those 6 months. It just felt like a new time. There was a real buoyancy. And I think, you know, to be fair to Ryan Lowe, he's the type of character who can get that out of people, can like drum up confidence in them. He's a very good motivator of people across the board. And yeah, I just, well, pretty much every week for 4 or 5 months before COVID happened, worked with some really good people, including Dan and Rick and Megan and Nino as well. I can't remember if I've forgotten anybody else. Obviously, Charlie more indirectly, but, you know, all of those people were great, and I really enjoyed it. And it was a good time to be around the club. And, you know, I only saw the good side of it, really. Obviously, I saw the difficulties of working in a media department and having to, as Dan alluded to, kind of, you know, sort of the reputation and the morale of the players. You are the sort of public thing for that. So you've got to try and, even sometimes if it's not the 100% truth, have to mold a picture of that the fans want to see. That's the kind of media, and that's PR and whatever. Just a bit disappointed, as we all were, that it kind of, you know, ended so abruptly. But, you know, I sort of never forget those sort of 5 months or whatever.
Yeah, so going into COVID then, that season, I agree with Dan, really. It was a bit of a lightning in the bottle that season. I don't think any other club has been so excited for a first season back down after being relegated as Argyle fans were that season. And the season was going pretty well. It had a bit of a slow start. Maybe over the kind of autumn and winter months, we were really motoring, weren't we? And then the season stopped. I think just for the first time all season, we'd got on top three on points per game. And it's like a musical chair. It's like, where are you when the music stopped? Any other point in the season, if COVID had hit and if the season had been decided in the same way, obviously they were never going to decide it that way in August, but I think at pretty much any other point in the season up to that Macclesfield game, we would not have been in the top three on points per game. And I think finally we were for the first time. So we were really clicking into form at the right time. And it is often something that I let my mind sort of wander onto and daydream about is how that season would have ended. I think we'd have given Swindon a really good go for the title myself, but I guess we'll never know. So COVID itself, as you said, Dan, I think that was, again, a really insightful point that media during that time, obviously, you know, not necessarily so much those first few months because nothing was happening, but certainly when the season then resumed in September and that weird season in League One that followed, media was the way people followed their clubs. You know, previously, don't get me wrong, you obviously still played a huge part, but you were not the primary conduit for which most people followed Argyle, and then you were. I believe there was some, before we go on to maybe how that was, I believe there was a little bit of restructuring in the media team around that time. I believe Rick left and a couple of others came in. Is that right?
Yeah, it was kind of, I think it was broader than the media department. it was kind of more kind of holistic. So, I mean, I think if we go back to when COVID, it's interesting you mentioned that Maxwell game, but leading up to that week, we had kind of clocked that, hey, this was getting quite bad and maybe we shouldn't be playing football, maybe we won't be playing football. We had that Grimsby rearranged game in the middle of the week, didn't we, from when a panel blew off earlier in the season. And, you know, we may have beaten Grimsby that day back in November. I think it was the day of the Rugby World Cup final. We may have beaten them then, but we were certainly going to beat them when we replayed them. Just the way that we were, the form we were in, we were a much, much better team 3 months down the line. I think form-wise, we were probably the best team in the league at that time. Maybe not over the entire season, but we were finishing strongly, and I think we were going to finish strongly. I know that we snuck in there just as the shutters came down. I know it's really easy to say, and obviously in a hugely biased position, but I did see them at the day to day. I just thought they weren't going to lose very many games. They were just in such a good place. The team, we were playing so well. We were starting to routinely roll teams at home, in particular. But yeah, I mean, I remember us thinking kind of, hey, this isn't going to be great. And the team were on the coach to Morecambe, I think, had set off. And we got the announcement that I think firstly it was postponed for a short period of time and then it was postponed kind of indefinitely. And that interim period was so bizarre that I will hopefully none of us ever experience it again. But I mean, the football club, once the kind of, I can't quite recall how quickly things like furlough came into being, but the club went down to not that many staff. Quite a lot of people were furloughed when there was nothing happening. And so I remember we were doing all sorts of random stuff. I know I played a Connect Four game against Exeter City when the game should have been played.
I remember the Football Manager thing you did as well.
We played games of Football Manager when we should have been playing the actual games. I think we did. Charlie and I just spent like there was nothing else happening, and I think it speaks to how daft we are. But I think we made like a silly Football Manager promo for one of the games where, you know. Anyway, it was just such an odd time. We were trying to dig out every piece of archive footage of matches we had that we could share with the fans to keep everyone's spirits high. The only sport, if you could call it that, which you can, I think it was going on at the time, was FIFA esports. And I think the club had just partnered with an esports team to play esports. So I remember when we used to do kind of match previews for football matches, instead I would call up a man who lived in Liverpool and ask him about his FIFA game tonight and put that on the website. You know, it was just a really odd time. And I mean, obviously, I'm talking about the silly stuff, but the bigger picture was that the club, that Simon obviously put money in to ensure that the club would stay afloat. But there were obviously conversations happening about what football looked like, what the club was going to look like out the other end of it. And some decisions were made and a restructure took place. All the while we'd handed the stadium over to the NHS. Firstly, before it became the vaccination centre, the club was really proactive, you know, and credit to everybody involved. Christian, Zach, Andrew, Jamie, all the guys who kind of got their heads together. James Greenacre as well, who's not there anymore either, who went, okay, we've got this massive resource in a time of real genuine need in Plymouth. Let's do the right thing. And I know, you know, eventually it was the case that obviously we received some form of rent arrangement with the NHS on a longer term basis, but that certainly wasn't the motivation for anyone. It was kind of do the right thing. And I think the club, that was when, to me, obviously we'd had a successful season up to that point anyway, but that felt to me when the club really was started to find its position as this like community leader, community asset, where we kind of took our place in Plymouth and Devon and really led from the front in terms of, you know, civic engagement and so on. And aside from the results on the pitch, I think that's the thing for me anyway, that's the thing I'm most proud of my football club for, is what it's become to people in the area. And, you know, we can go on to stuff later, but obviously Project 35 is an extension of that and all the great work that they do for people in the area. I think it's, for me, it's the best thing about Plymouth, to be honest.
Hold up. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
I couldn't agree more. So going on to that season itself then, the experience of, I suppose in a way, it must have been incredibly like happy feeling in one way that you were sort of getting to see the team play when nobody else was. But in a way, it must have put an enormous amount of pressure on it was the media team. I mean, obviously, I know that you wouldn't have been involved in the actual filming per se yourself, but the wider media operation, Argyle TV, it would have actually still been iFollow then, wouldn't it? That was pre-Argyle TV. But the Argyle Club media operation was providing that path for fans to watch and follow the game. So how was that going around the day-to-day of that season? Because I think it was it was a bit of a weird season, wasn't it? Even aside from the fact that no fans were in, it was a funny old season, wasn't it? We were so good in some games and so attacking and threatening, but so, you know, leaky at the back as well. What was that season like on a day-to-day basis for you?
I think I was incredibly privileged, obviously, to go to the games, but the privilege is a curse sometimes when you're one of about 15 people in the stadium and you've lost 6-0 at home to Charlton and you have to go and, you know, speak to the manager afterwards and try and figure out a way to, you know, rationalise that defeat, you know. That was quite hard. I think we went into the season. I think there was the budget wasn't large. It wasn't large for any club at the time, but I think we were being really practical with ensuring that there would be a club. Obviously, after all the work that everybody, Sam, you know, that you did in keeping the club afloat, it's never far from anyone's mind. I know it's easy to say that, but having worked there, there is a genuine shared belief from everybody that works there. And most of them are, you know, Argyle fans, to be honest. And work incredibly hard and incredibly talented and to try and protect and build the club. But it's never far from anyone's mind that we nearly lost the entire football club and there's no desire to ever do that again. So we took a relatively conservative position, I think. You know, I think you'll probably see in the loans that we brought in that season, they were quite inexperienced. They were obviously all talented players, but very early in their careers, probably weren't commanding, I'm not privy to that sort of information anyway, but they probably weren't commanding huge salaries, and it was a way to ensure we had a good 20-odd strong squad who could compete in League One. But I still think that there was kind of this factor that we'd come out of League Two, still a big club even at League One level, bit of upward momentum, talented coaching staff, a solid sense of purpose and really a really solid structure and ownership behind the scenes, we felt that we might compete, I think. But it tailed off in a not dissimilar fashion to the last league season at that level, except we'd already kind of got enough points on the board to be all right. But there were still some amazing highlights. I mean, I think that Lincoln game that we won 4-3, where Joe scored a sumptuous volley from the edge of the area. You know, I just remember thinking if there were fans in here, the roof would have come off, and it was just
that,
me.
That would have been remembered for
punching the air in the press box in an empty stadium. It was truly bizarre, you know, a really bizarre experience. The players all running around giddy, hugging each other, but you can just hear them kind of squealing and nothing else. And, you know, you've been in the stadium, both of you, and there have been big historic goals. It's loud. There's nothing like it. You can't replicate it in kind of any walk of life. And here that we've just done that against a team that should have and nearly did get promoted that year. At least I think that's the year that they lost in the playoffs. But
yeah, it was, yeah.
You know, it was an amazing game. We were up, we were down, and then, you know, turned it around. And that that would have found its place in one of those games that everybody talked about forever, if only there were people there. Because it's not the same watching it on the screen. Similarly, you know, we went up to Sunderland and won. How often does that happen? And these small moments where you're like, wow, I'm extremely privileged to have been able to see that game in the flesh. But I must say that we were kind of grateful to see that season end when we got into the end of it, because it was, we'd gotten ourselves safe, I think, with five or six games to go. We really had some like significantly depleted squad at that time. We were tired. We were playing like three games a week. It was relentless. I remember there was a week where I think I'm right in saying we went to Swindon and we won, and then we went to Sheffield United in the cup. We lost, and then we went to Sunderland like 3 days later. Or it may not be in that order, but it was like that. It was those three games, three consecutive away games. Like, I barely saw my kids from the family. It wasn't a lot. It wasn't much fun for everyone, but we needed to do it because we needed to be there at the other side. And the fact, you know, for all we talk about it not being the same, and it really wasn't. You know, it was something for people to watch at home. It was their team in some format. It was their team. But obviously we were relying on technology as well, and that was stressful because I think historically up to that point, we put a fair bit of money into renovating the suite, which is now obviously doing amazing things with the Argyle TV production that they've got in there. But up until that season, it'd been a sort of running joke that you would have to tweet 3 minutes into the game, apologies for iFollow not quite working, we're working on it, sorry, please don't shout at us too much, we're trying to fix it.
We never have any technical problems in our production, of course. Absolutely no
chance. But, you know, Jamie Yabsey, who's the head of marketing and communications, put the business case together to get that done properly, no expense spared. And I mean, I think you can see it reaped the rewards in it. You know, the guys that we've got working on the content there, and having people like Charlie Price in a permanent position at the club, I'm not just saying that because I used to work with them, but I mean, the quality of the production now that I enjoy it as a fan, it's so good for the level that we're at, and to have the people there, and they're all fans. I think that helps because they kind of know, they think, and certainly that was what I felt. What the fans are thinking, because you're thinking it yourself when you're watching your team.
I think from a fan's perspective, was it our goal for us, you know, a really short period of time. There's a real kind of thing that you kind of encompass when you sort of work at the place and it, but you have been a fan all your life. It's like you have to do the media side of it, but don't get me wrong, you're still that fan, and you still have biases. You still want to shout at the referee when it's not going well, you know. And I think you became quite a popular figure on sort of Argyle Twitter but that's because I think people could see that you were a fan, do you know what I mean? In the way that you tweeted, and that takes a real skill to sort of like be a media man, but also be a fan at the same time. When you get the balance right, like you did, and like Charlie has, and all those people at the club now, I think that's when you get a sort of, you know, that's when you get a successful media team.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I get it right 100% of the time or got it right 100% of the time, but I think people can see, and you can see how much everyone shares in the thing that you want is the thing that they want, and that's really helpful. And in terms of being authentic, I guess, and being believable, and looking at the club Twitter account and thinking, you know, people could, you know, by all means they'd have valid criticisms from time to time of the things we do, but they know that we were always just trying to achieve the thing that they wanted us to achieve, always. You know, our goal was their goal. We weren't trying to pull the wall, you know, never trying to pull the wall over anyone's eyes, trying to be as transparent as you could possibly be and share as much as you possibly can without obviously compromising yourselves one way or another. But really what it comes down to is, you know, often I'll feel the way about the team's performance that the supporters will feel. When we've won, invariably I'm able to say the same thing as they would, won't be amazing, get in there, whatever. When we lose, obviously you have to take a different position, You know, nobody's disingenuous and would tell you that we played brilliantly when we didn't. But obviously we have a sympathetic, we have more knowledge of why, or more insight into why a performance might not have gone the way we wanted, or what the build-up was like in the week, really, truly. And we're more sympathetic. And obviously the players become your friends, and it's kind of your responsibility to protect them. So I just always felt, you know, every day that I turned up to work, even when it was difficult, which fortunately hasn't been that often, we all felt, I'm sure everyone who still works there now does, just an immense privilege to be able to do that job, get paid to turn up and work with your football club every day. It's just, it is a dream. There's no question. It was kind of the only thing I would have ever wanted to do when I was growing up. And amazing opportunity.
Really interesting insights, Dan. I honestly feel that I'm not John. I don't say this for every guest. I feel we could talk for hours about this. I really could, but I'm conscious that we want to speed it up a little, because I'm sure I want to let you get some of your evening back. So there are, obviously, we want to talk about the 101 point season, and there are a couple of other bits I want to ask you at the end as well. But just to briefly sort of whistle stop tour over the 80 point season where we missed out in the playoffs, then obviously the big event, I guess, from a media point of view, was Ryan leaving halfway through to go to Preston, and obviously the immediate decision of appointing Stephen Schumacher as manager. Now, the thing that struck me about that is, I think that's the first time I've ever seen the club announce the appointment of a new manager before announcing that the old manager had left. And that's not in any way a criticism, but I thought it was absolutely genius, because what it did is it turned the attention on the positive and sort of maybe killed the negative momentum that was growing. And I remember, we all knew it was happening. And I remember that that Tuesday afternoon, just seeing, because I have Argyle tweet notifications on my phone, seeing it pop up, and I'm thinking, right, this is going to be the Ryan Lowe's been given permission to talk. But actually what I saw was Stephen Schumacher's been appointed to the club's new manager. Was that a conscious decision to deliver the news that way?
Yes, it was, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll talk you through as much as I can. We got a kind of 24 hours maybe notice on it. You know, I was aware of it 24. I'm sure, you know, obviously Andrew and Zach and the board and the management above me would have known sooner than that. But I got the kind of brief kind of 9 p.m. the night before. No, I got the brief at 5, and then I got the brief to start writing at 9 p.m. the night before. And it's interesting that we were just having the conversation about everyone being fans, but the thing that struck me and the thing that struck Jamie as well, who was my boss at the time, and we chatted about the kind of positioning of the statement, was actually the club has got is developing a track record for making correct decisions, right? It has done. Over a period of time, it was making the right calls. The call was made that they wanted Stephen Schumacher to be the manager. You know, looking back however many years on now, coming up for 2 years on, is it? You can't argue that that was the wrong decision. So let's back ourselves. And then the other thing that came into mind was the experience that we had as fans when it took really, really long time for the club to sort of, I guess, like there was a real lag between the kind of rumours of Holloway departing and a decision being made or an outcome. And I think the talk in the press from Stapleton and so on at the time was, we really don't want him to go, we're making him an offer, etc. And I just remember we all sat there, like you say, on Pasotti, wringing our hands, refreshing, waiting for the news. We all knew what was happening. And actually we knew we'd made our call, we'd backed our man, we saw the qualities that Shiri had before he became the manager, and obviously they've borne out and then some, probably. Let's not leave everyone hanging. So we went, we made the call, which was endorsed kind of by the CEO and everyone, to announce Shiri immediately, as soon as we had the necessary paperwork in from Preston to say, yes, Ryan was going. And so that's what we did. I don't know that it went down well everywhere, but that was the rationale, was that, and there was also this kind of view, we were in and around the playoffs at the time, I can't remember exactly where, but we were up there, obviously we were up there for the whole season, we had to play MK on Sky in 2 days, and I think it was really important for Shiri as well, it was really important for the fans to feel kind of some closure, some clarity, some real clarity on where we were going, I think it was really important for us to make that public endorsement of Shiri in that way, to say, he's our guy, think no more of it. We've got a game in 2 days and we're carrying on. And obviously the club has, across all areas, really strong succession planning and thought process that goes into all departments and everything. And they'd identified that Shiri was the guy. And, you know, I back their judgment. And I agreed with it, by the way, but, you know, I back their judgment immensely. So let's be brave and let's keep the season rolling. And obviously, you know, we got so close to the playoffs. But in the end, I think, you know, that was a really competitive season. Not that the following one was much easier, but we managed to just carry that momentum through, which is incredible, really.
I think from a fan's perspective at the time, I don't know about you, Sam, like on the outside, I never had a thing with me. Obviously, this is not in any way discrediting the really good job that Ryan Lowe did, but I never had a feeling. It was like, you know, sometimes as a fan, you know, your club appoints a manager and it's like, could be a waiting for somebody else. I never had that feeling. Even for me at the time, it was like, it felt like the right decision, just as, because I felt like we had good momentum. So I didn't want to change from that as a fan, you know? I didn't want to change from the style or anything like that.
Yeah, totally. I think I was a little bit further removed from the players at that point. So, like, I didn't know them as well as maybe I did the season before. But from what the conversation I'd had with kind of Charlie Rose, who's in and around them filming every day, was that there very much was a view that not a huge amount would change, because Shiri was really, really involved in the way that we played already. But I think what you can see is, obviously, I think it's, I'd obviously not like to get into this position anyway, knowing both Ryan and Shiri and respecting them both immensely. But I think what you can see from the job that Ryan has done at Preston is that he is a good manager in and of himself. He's doing an excellent job there. And Shiri's doing an excellent job here. They're both just really good championship quality managers with lots of potential. But you could see there was just continuity from the get-go, wasn't there? And obviously Shiri handled press and handled the occasion and has handled everything else remarkably ever since. But they did just carry on. That wasn't just kind of for the papers. That was the reality of the situation. They all came in and Shiri was the gaffer now, and they just kept playing this, you know, similarly, and got really close to the playoffs that year.
Yeah. Now the obviously we got close to the playoffs, and I think almost any other year that would have been enough to make the playoffs, an 80-point total, wouldn't it? I think only one year in the last 20 up to then would that have not been enough. So, you know, we were all a bit gutted. Certainly the way it ended with that awful loss on the final day was very dispiriting. But, you know, who can argue in the following season we built back up, we added where we were weaker, we built on where we were already strong, and what followed was quite simply the most incredible season in the club's history. And I don't think it's hyperbole to say that in any way. I don't really want to ask you too many questions per se about that, because I really think we could be here for a good hour or two on that season alone, if not longer. But it, just in your words, talk us through the experience of being a core part of the club's media team during such an incredible historic season as that, then.
I think the job's easy when you're winning. Like, from my point of view, it was just, you know, we just became this machine, didn't we? It's just incredible. I agree. I think, you know, I can't speak for seasons before my time, but I think it eclipses 03-04 by a distance because of the standard of the league, the way the finances have changed. Obviously, the fact that we hit triple figures, heartbreaking day at Wembley, but we got there, you know, we were just so good. But I think, like you said, about that kind of that euphoria that came around the club, sort of the 1920 season, it just felt like that, but possibly even stronger. You had all of these characters, you know, all of these guys that played for the club, but just great blokes that it's just really easy to root for. The stuff that they do behind the scenes, a lot of them, you know, they kind of do it and then ask it. And from my point of view, obviously as the PR person, I'm like, oh, we should do something on that. And they say, actually, no, I don't want the attention. They'll go and do something for charity. They'll go and donate some stuff to a food bank and say, please don't put anything out. I just want to do this. And, you know, those are the sorts of guys that we've recruited. Those are the sorts of people that play for us. And, you know, just seeing players like Barley and Morgan and everyone like that, you know, just express themselves on the pitch every day. It wasn't just that we were winning games, it was just playing such great stuff. And I wasn't sure, you know, I wasn't sure how you follow losing 5-0 on the final day and falling out of the playoffs, having been pretty much in them the whole season or in and around them. I didn't know how you followed that, given the strength of clubs that we were up against. You know, Derby had come down and everyone thought they were going to be stronger than they turned out to be, and obviously Sheffield Wednesday and Ipswich were incredible. Barnsley, I don't have the figures to hand, but I think their points total might have got them promoted, even from fourth, historically a fair chunk of the time. It was just remarkable, really, to be honest. But it was that day at Derby where I thought something might happen. I just think we had so many of those kind of clutch games. Ipswich was a clutch game, Derby, Sheffield Wednesday, where I think Cosgrove should have had one of the clearest penalties I've ever seen in the 94th minute, and we still somehow go on and win that game. Just that, like, every time, the Exeter game where we fall behind twice, and Barley shoots from 400 yards out and it rips the net off, you know. Just like any one of those games could go down on merit as one of the best games that we've played, and they all happened within like a 3 or 4 minute period of each other. Barley scoring at Ipswich right at the end, you know, it was just a dream season in every sense of the word, you know, apart from the Papa John's game, which we'll move swiftly past, I think.
I think for me that was mildly diverting rather than heartbreaking. I think I said quite gladly I would take a thumping if we won every league game after that, which we pretty much did, to be fair, barring the Lincoln game. Now, obviously, then that season ended. You left to pursue other opportunities. What's it been like now going back to Argyle as a fan? Is that weird going back into fan mode after being in job mode?
It is to an extent. But I think I left on great terms, and I'm really grateful to the club for everything they've done for me and everyone I've met there. And, you know, I'll never forget it. It was an amazing 4.5 years dream job. I think I've been to, I've managed to get to a few games this year. Obviously, I've got a young family, as the recording has spoken to. So not having to, you know, schlep up and down to games every weekend and spend a bit of time at home has been really valuable. I owe that to my family. But I just sort of gone back to following it pretty much like I did before. But after a game, I might text one of the players and say, nice goal, mate, or whatever, you know, Ryan Hardy or so on. Keep in touch with all the pals who work there. I sat in the director's box for the Sheffield Wednesday game, which was a very odd experience for me. I think when you can leave football and everything that football is, and you can leave it on good terms, on your own terms as well, like, I'm really grateful for that, because it's not often that you can do that, to be honest. Football can be quite a harsh industry. So being back in the stands, I work kind of hybrid. I'm still in Plymouth, but I work hybrid in London. So I'm going to get to an away game. I'm going to get to QPR in the away end, which it's been a while since I've done that. And obviously, that for the most part, it's so much better being able to be involved in the club. But sometimes when a goal goes in and at a game and you've scored a goal, in that moment, you don't want to be searching for the player goal gift to tweet. You actually want to be jumping down four flights of stairs and in the away end, you know, like Macca's goal at Chelsea. I sort of grabbed Matt, who's the marketing manager, I just grabbed his arm and went, did that go in? When I looked over to 6,000 Janners going absolutely ballistic, and I thought, in this moment, I'd actually rather be in the stand. Everything that comes before and after that, it's an immense privilege to do. But I feel at peace with it. I feel it was the right time for me to go. It's the right time for somebody else to have a go as well, you know. It's an amazing job, and lots of people want to have the opportunity to do it and deserve the opportunity to do it. So I feel like I gave it everything I could give it. I helped shape what is now an amazing media department, an amazing club. Now it's somebody else's turn and I'll go and do something else. But been an amazing time and go back to being a fan now, which is great.
Absolutely. And I think everyone would agree that the general operation was hugely changed. And again, this is not in any way to denigrate or be disrespectful to people who were there before you, but it just felt so authentic. It felt like it was a fan tweeting, which it was. I'm not saying it wasn't before, but I feel that the way football is going across football Twitter accounts generally and sports, you know, same with other sports, club cricket as well, it seems to, you know, seems to go in the same way. There is that tendency to treat like a fan on a way that really sort of emotively resonates, the kind of older school, you know, more slightly editorialized, more detached approach is on the way out. And I guess that was something you really consciously tried to bring in through your time, wasn't there, to an extent?
Yeah, I think so on Twitter specifically, because that's the way that the platform operates. It kind of rewards that. It's for that immediacy. So I think, yes, definitely, there was a shift towards communicating like a fan as best as you can. With, you know, we go close to the line at times, try not to cross it. Obviously, every now and then we got it wrong, and we'd have to just swallow that. But on the whole, I think, you know, that authenticity of voice. It has been an aim. Obviously, I think if you got on the website, there's still an awful lot of really good written content there, which was definitely the focus in the kind of previous era, which, you know, I still love to read personally, but I know it's not for everyone. And when you're on Twitter looking for your club news or looking for your club content, then you are looking for your club content probably more than you're looking to read. So I think there's room for both, but certainly on Twitter, it was a conscious effort to try and engage with the fans and really capitalize. I think a lot of the things I've kind of either directly or kind of indirectly received credit for, I think I benefited from being just in the right place at the right time when it was quite an easy and obvious thing to do. I think obviously we made some conscious decisions that were taken away from that. But I think broadly, I lucked in massively in being in the role that I was in at the point in the club's history that it was at. You know, you couldn't move for a positive story. And that's still the case now, really. And I think they're doing an amazing job as is. And I think, you know, my personal view, we're playing the exact right way if we want to grow the club. If you want to keep recruiting players like Morgan and Barley, when they obviously have other options, you know, because they are outstanding players, you have to play a style and a system where they know they're going to get opportunities to play. So, like, as much as I understand the rhetoric around us needing to defend better, it's not rhetoric. I mean, we would like to concede fewer goals. I think the last time we were at this level, I don't know if you agree, Sam, but it did feel like we would just try and nick a set piece and hang on, and that's the way to stay up for a year, but it's not the way to build a football club. And obviously with the new 5-year plan that they've got, they want to be in the top six. So you really have to play, you really have to have an identifiable style and some reasons to come and join Plymouth Argyle over five or six other good championship clubs who want to sign you, because that's the market now the club is operating in. But, you know, I can't be more positive about my time there or the direction the club's going in. And, you know, for my part, I just want to, you know, tell anybody who's listening all the things that we tell you are, to be honest, pretty true. It's an outstanding staff and culture and an amazing place to be.
Absolutely. And I really hope that by the time of listening, some of that slightly cavalier style of football will have really paid off and we start winning some of these games 3-2 or 3-1, because for context of the listeners, if you're casting your minds back listening to this a bit further on, we're just coming off the November international break going into the Sunderland game where we've had so many good performances but not quite got the results we need. So hopefully that will change, and indeed has changed before we've heard it now. Dan, there is one final question I'm burning to ask you before we do call this a night, but it kind of relates back to something that you said to me before that stayed with me. It was when Argyle Life was sponsoring George Cooper and we were were there for a sponsorship event of some kind, just having a picture taken with him and that, and that sort of thing. We had a little chat walking out about the nature of fan analysis like Argyle Life, and I remember it was relating to an article that we'd put out. I think it was Nick Saunders-Smith put it out at the time about suggesting Anthony Sarcevic should play wing back, and I remember you saying that it's as great as it is, obviously it's not my job to say whether he should play wing back. It's my job to say that Joe Riley's at wing back and he's brilliant there. What I'm leading on to with that question is, how much of an extent is the growth of fan media, because it is growing. We've got numerous, every championship club in the league has a podcast. Some have multiple podcasts, and written articles are on the rise as well. How much of that fan media kind of opining on the ins and outs, who should play, who shouldn't play, how much of that is really a disruption or a distraction around the football club, and how much of it is just background noise? Sorry, I'm aware that question went on for about 2 minutes, but I hope you got the gist of it.
No, I get it. I think, well, obviously in my role, it's my job to read, or it was my job to read what fans are saying across the board, monitor it, read it. Probably agree with some of it, disagree with some of it, as with anything. I think anybody that tells you that they don't pay attention, which obviously you probably hear quite a lot, is not strictly true. Everyone reads. Particularly if it generates any sort of traction, if it's one tweet falls off the bottom of the hashtag, then of course maybe it doesn't cut through. But if there's anything that generates kind of any noise whatsoever, you can be sure that people have read it. I suppose the question is around whether it permeates into the coaching staff. Is that a fair question? Is that a fair assessment?
Well, one very interesting thing that Shuey said, which was one of the most interesting things I think he'd ever said, is about when Sam Codsdale got those two late goals at Derby. He said he certainly shut a few up on Twitter, and whilst I don't disagree with the sentiment, he kind of and a couple of other things he said hinted it as well. It kind of maybe not unnerved me, but sort of surprised me that the manager was so intimately in touch with what people were saying to that extent,
I think with Sam, it was really profound, the feedback that there was in relation to his signing. I remember thinking that was, possibly, to be honest, and I don't mean sort of in written analysis articles, I just mean in the initial response. I think
the Twitter storm,
there's no way that. So the manager will have a look at the announcement tweet, won't they? And then they'll just see the replies and think, bloody hell, has anybody said anything nice at all? And I think that's fair. I think in the context of, now obviously it's really easy for him to come out and say, after Sam scored twice, we've come back from 2-0 down, his adrenaline's off the charts, at that point in time. If you place a brick in front of him, he probably could have snapped it in half. But I think there's obviously some merit to what he's saying. There's an awful lot of work that goes in. They've got several full-time staff members who are analysing players' strengths beyond what you can see in their goals return, beyond what you can see, deep dives into data, benchmarking, so on. They identified that Sam had certain skills and he clearly contributed significantly to the promotion. So I think that's probably an extreme example and Shuey's obviously he's an honest broker, isn't he? He's passionate, and he, as all good managers have to, he has the courage of his convictions, and he sees a response like that after an amazing sort of 18 months plus the promotion that preceded that, and you're thinking, well, maybe have the message was probably have a bit of faith in what we're doing here. And I also think there's a tendency to look in general terms and make an assumption that Sam, for example, because he was large and a striker, was a target man. But actually, if you really watched his play, all of his best play was facing goal.
He was so far from a target man.
He was a complete forward. He played that style. He didn't play long pivot ball. So I still see now, people refer to the lack of a perceived target man and say, oh, we should have gone back in for Sam. Well, Sam's large, but he's not a target man.
Ennis is far more of a target man in the way
he played amazing. He used his back to goal he was far more that player. And you see it with certain players now who I think are benefiting from the place we occupy in this pyramid, where, for example, I think Ryan Hardy's having a far superior season at this level than he did last season. I thought he had a good season last season, but I think he benefits from it because the areas in which he excels are better against teams that don't play a low block and sit back because we're the best team in the league, because we're in the bottom half. They press high on us because they've got more technically able players and play more expansive ways. There's more room for Ryan to run in behind. There's more room for Jordan Houghton to pick passes in a way that he wasn't able to do in congestion last season. And suddenly you see different sides of players. So, I mean, I don't have a better knowledge of, other than obviously having better access. I don't have a better footballing knowledge than you know, anybody else on Twitter, for example. And I might make the same assessment, but I think it's obviously it's clear that they've got a real strategy, a real plan, and we need to kind of, and I'm with everybody else now, we just need to have some faith in the recruitment to identify these players. And I think they've got a great track record of doing so. Morgan playing his position, he wasn't a 10 before he came to us, and now he's, you know, tearing up in the Championship. Barley's playing further forward, etc. You know, there are tons of examples of, you know, Joe Edwards has gone from being released from a relegated League One Walsall, like Dan Scar, and becoming, for my money, as good a captain as the club's had in its history. You know, it's just.
I wonder what Walsall fans must think seeing Edwards and Scar thriving so much for us in 101 point title season. Must be thinking, what on earth? But I'm glad you said. I know you said you've got no more knowledge than anyone else, but it backed up. But I was saying at the time, people were talking about Corrigan being a target man, and. Well, he's not really. I mean, you could say he's direct because he's big and strong, but really, he's he was a poacher who happened to be 6'3" and built like Rick Verbeel. You know, that was what the kind of player he was. And anyway, we're kind of going way off track. But Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Is there anything else you'd like to add before you go?
No, just kind of reiterate what I said really, which is that it's been an amazing place to work. You know. An amazing part of my life, I'll never forget it. You know, the club is full of amazingly hardworking, talented people who are trying to make the entire supporter base proud and trying to build the club and take it as far as possible. And I think as much credit as the top dogs deserve, and they do, because they've been transformational for the football club, I think it permeates through kind of everyone. I just wanted to point out that these guys are unbelievable. I don't think there's ever been a stronger era for the football club, and I'm just grateful to have been a part of it and to get to reminisce on some good times with you chaps, which has been fantastic. So thank you.
I feel we've kind of only just scratched the surface. If you haven't got any more stories you want to tell us, I'm sure we could book you back in. But either way, Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Finn. Thank you for joining me as well. And I hope the listeners enjoyed that as much as I think we all enjoyed recording it. So thank you very much and goodbye.
Bye.
Oh, here we go. Stop recording. That would be the hope, wouldn't it?
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.